Thank you so much. The time that brought me to... How's the sound? Okay. That brought me to leave Pacifica was, I think, as much as 11 or 12 years ago. And it was because old age was already coming on. Well, it's here. And yet, there's something interesting about talking or being when you're not sure. You're not sure if you're going to remember. You know, you're not sure if... then if your clothes are on, you know, right. And so in some way you really... At a deeper and deeper level, I feel gratitude when I hear that blessing. It is wonderful. I wish each of one of you could have that sense of a group blessing you. You might have had your baptism or you're joining a group in any other way. But it's wonderful to have that experience of you for one moment being set aside and welcomed by the community. So I thank you. Perhaps you've seen and noticed this illustration here. It's really not where we're going to begin. It's where I hope we end. But I want to say something about it, and then we'll, you know, start moving in some kind of circuitous way to one of the things that this particular drawing can hold. How many of you have seen it before in some form or the other? Okay. In some forms it has... let me describe it if you haven't seen it up close. This is fields and a tree, and here is a man, a seeker it would seem, and he has gone the whole way up to the stars and broken through and discovered something beyond the stars. This is placed as a Sufi drawing. That's the mystical side of Islam. And I don't know where the original is, but on Google you can find loads and loads and loads of variations of it. And in fact, I know some people who have it on their card. You know, that's the illustration they chose. So he's breaking through to something beyond the stars. At Pacifica, we use this illustration, and we use some work by a 20th century author, Henri Corbin, who wrote a lot about the mundus imaginalis, a concept of the imaginal, not imaginary, but imaginal world of the Sufi mind. And in the imaginal world, let me just say, put that aside. One of the reasons this was so foundational at Pacifica is that Pacifica is not simply in a Jungian tradition, and therefore a Jungian tradition of looking at the unconscious, but a Hillmanian, Jim Hillman, who died a few years ago, his interpretation, in which Jung's major or sort of idiosyncratic contribution to depth psychology was the notion of the archetypes. For Hillman, that idea that Jung brought forth was just a little on the stiff side. And so Hillman, if anything, he was incredibly dynamic, or saw things, or saw human behavior in a very dynamic way. So what Corbin interprets this drawing as piercing our environment to a place beyond, where there's not more environment as such, but a place that Hillman would name later in his archetypal psychology, archetypes. But these archetypes weren't simply like rigid, well-named, fixed. They had a certain element of moving to them, leaving room for us to gain more and more knowledge and much more and more experience, and then maybe recognizing something out there that was only dreamed of before. Because that place, and the place of the archetypal realm, is not unlike that of the dream world, where knowledge embedded in images appear to us nightly, if we can let them. You know, if we're not too drugged on sleep aid and melatonin. Melatonin might help, actually. Let me have some coffee before it goes. Before it goes cold. Okay, so we'll come back to this. I think this is is hinged enough that we can retain it and come back to it. Oops, unhinged. Okay, again, I know you're not going to be able to see this, but the good news is you already know it, because it is just a model here of the embarrassment of riches we've had with this book. I think this book could have been called Reconnecting. Each chapter is entitled Reconnecting With. And so I have in the center here of sort of a little device that sometimes we use to write a poem or even to write in our journal. The word reconnecting is like the theme of this and the theme of today. And of course, reconnecting means we have already been connected, and that we might still be connected, and we might need to just reconnect more deeply. So I put in here, the word under here is Catherine Collis, because after I put the name of each of the presenters, I realized I hadn't put Catherine Collis anywhere. And of course, she came and introduced this genre. You might say that John Newell, Philip Newell, is familiar with, and that is, I think I, you have more scotch tape there. See this? Okay. Oh, okay. Okay. Good. 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 So, anyhow, if we take this as our beginning place, let's just remember together. And I know there are some of you who are here today, and I thank you very much, and so haven't been with us the whole time. But the first reconnecting we did was with the earth. And here we're coming sort of circle or almost around to it again in that illustration. And that was Richard Grove. Okay, then we went to compassion with Jim Clark, who always is so important for us to connect with it, compassion with him, as well as many other things. Light, Pat McClure. I had planned to say something on each person when I realized I might be, you know, halfway through my presentation. But I wanted still to have everybody in the room in some way with us. Journey was Reverend Susan, and spiritual practice, Reverend Suzanne, Susan Copeland, and Dunn. Nonviolence last time, Dennis Pell. Not too many people we could have invited who have gone to jail for their nonviolence. And then Unconscious Me, and next week, we have love, Reverend Davis. I don't believe I more. Okay, all right. So allow yourself, especially if you have been a participant in this program all along, to feel the riches of this particular book. And if you haven't been reading along, go back and read it. It's good stuff. It's very good stuff. And in fact, I, by mistake, read the next chapter thinking it was the one I was doing. And he builds a lot on, oh gosh, I didn't write it down. This is what happens, isn't it? Simone Weil. And I ordered books on her and to read everything in context that was in there. And I don't mind, you know, I have those books, but whether or not he does expand on love using her or not, read it, because this woman was in her time at a similar time we are in. She died around 32, I think, and the whole energy in Europe of a kind of intolerance, dividing into those who were the clean, good people, and those who were trying to get in, you know. And so that energy is not undifferent from the energy we face now, and I hope that we make a different solution than the great solution that Hitler had for the people who were not considered to be high enough, the hierarchy, to be able to live in Europe. I was going to do a little piece, but I'm not. This is the end of this. But I can't risk this saying that I think right now we're past East and West split and we're into a North-South split. And those of us of the North think we're superior at some level, and those of the South, we're in at least Africa, but even in South America, are becoming the great famine. Just great famine. Imagine South America. Things grew, you know. I've been to nearly all the countries in South America, and they are green, usually. You don't expect people to be dying of famine. Okay. When we began, and when Martha led us, she led us to a place of silence, or a place of connecting, a place that from which we could connect, a place of quiet. The trouble with a place of quiet, like if we're going to begin meditation, we then turn up the volume on the inside. We can't help but think their thoughts, and sometimes they're jewels, and we might want to jot a word down. But I know in my own experience that the thoughts are often attacking of me thoughts. They're distracting thoughts in the line of demeaning ones. They're not all demeaning. Some of them are like my desire to be brilliant. You know? They come in all forms. So I would have us take on today and any other time that we want to that basic Buddhist practice of going back to one. This is, if I say it, one, I am going to be just present, and I'm going to be present to the breath, or I might be instead present to oneness. And then I say two, three. Well, there's a book that's entitled Back to One, because we can't sometimes even count to five without realizing our mind has wandered away. So I think for today, I'm going to ask you on the side to sort of hold a practice of Back to One. What in particular I think interrupts us is some form of self-recrimination. And, you know, that's not surprising, because at some level of survival, we are the most important person in our life. Yet, we can find the space in our heart. Pat McClure talks so much about allowing your heart to expand so that we allow our sort of fortune, good fortune or bad fortune, not to be the subject. And so we go back to one and pay attention again to our breathing. The image that I want to particularly develop here for the relation to the unconscious is that of non-dualism. Now, in the course of the 10 years I've been coming to Word and Life, we have done an enormous amount of work with non-dualism, a lot of it through Richard Rohr. And it sort of is there and then it's gone. You know, it's there and it's not gone. Because it is a concept that is extremely difficult, if not impossible, for our left brain to grasp. Yet if you look up who were proponents of non-dualism, you will find out nearly every branch of every religion in Asia, whether it's Japan, Korea, China, those we're more, maybe more familiar with, that their notion was of a radical non-dualism. But we, for the most part, with some exceptions in this room, we're for the most part not students of non-dualism. We grew up in a very dualistic world. So I'm going to present two or three images that I think could be helpful for you. Anybody know what this is? A Möbius strip. Möbius was a mathematician. I've known about this for a long time, since my first career was mathematics. And, you know, if I look at a sheet up there, that's sort of a two-dimensional sheet in a three-dimensional world, and I'm out of it. I'm not in it. But if I look at this and I say, well, suppose I'm an ant crawling along this. All right, and what I have here are two others, two little smaller ones, that I thought could make their way around. Keith, do you want it to hold it at all and then pass it on to Tom? If I were to mark, say, something on this side of it, and then I were to take a path around, what's going to happen as I start to get back to where my finger was? I'll be on the other side. All right, so suppose we say this side, this instrument would best be done if it was one color on one side and one on the other. On the other hand, it wouldn't, because when I join them, it would be, what's this? Okay, so what this gives me some kind of a sense of, suppose I think I'm in the unconscious, and then all of a sudden I realize I'm conscious. I'm conscious of the unconscious. Or it might be the other way around. I think I'm conscious, and I get in an accident. I certainly was unconscious of something very important. And so we see that there is really an interplay of these two, consciousness and unconsciousness, so that we cannot separate them in the way we needed to think of separation just to get out of a place of no thought. What I don't want to do is be demeaning to the notion of consciousness. You know, if you're a mother and you have children, you know, when they say mom for the first time, you're thrilled because you know they know there's a separation. So in some ironic way, in order to be full human beings, we need to separate. We need to go to a dualism that says, I'm not you. And yet at some point we need to come to the place and say, I am you. You know, and you are me. So we're trying to hold something that it's a mystery, but more than half the world aspires to it. It's sort of almost only the scientific community, and a scientific community that doesn't go too far into science, that balks at it. Because, let me just say that. Okay, so just one more image here before. As a teacher of geometry, I learned how to make almost a perfect circle at the blackboard. I did this on the table over there. Neither my circle is perfect, nor my color, you know, dividing that. But I did not intend for this side to be larger. I'm sure you recognize this as the yin-yang symbol. What I want to use it for is a symbol for non-duality, which it really it is. But it's because there's one particular place in the symbol that helps us, and it's this, that in the white portion of this Taoist symbol, there's black. Oh, no, it's red. Sorry. And on this side, there's the white. And it is sort of to stand for the notion that if I'm in this territory I call white, the deeper I go into it, there I'll find black. And vice versa. So it is an image that can help to remind us that there is no such thing as pure consciousness, nor pure unconsciousness, at least in creation. I don't know about in non-creation. Now, there's no way that we could, I think, or I could, talk about the unconscious without talking a little bit about Freud. Freud, often by people of our interest, gets totally bashed. Yeah. But luckily for me, at Pacifica we had a woman there who was quite learned. She's still there, and I'm hoping her name's going to come up because I didn't write it down. Okay, it'll come back. If nothing else, Freud's heroism in talking seriously about the unconscious, but also seriously about myth, which are our original stories and are not something that we can say, they have nothing for the modern person. You know, they have nothing for us. Freud found to his chagrin that he recognized elements in his own life that were very similar to a myth. What myth? Oedipal myth. The Oedipal myth. Remember the Oedipal complex? The Oedipal myth is about a couple, a king and a queen, Jocasta and Laius. And they were told by the Sphinx that if they had a son, that he would grow up one day to kill his father and marry his mother. And they didn't like that idea. So they told one of their servants, a shepherd, to abandon the baby on the hillside so the baby would die. And lo and behold, another shepherd picked him up and sold him down a chain to another king and queen who were childless and were very happy. But they never bothered to tell Oedipus that through his life. So he did not know of the message. Oedipus, as he was sort of branching out into the land, he was in a hurry to get somewhere, and there was a narrow passage, and the old lumbering guy in his carriage in the narrow passage just wouldn't get out of his way, and so he bumped him off, and of course he was his dad. And then he gets back home, and lo and behold, the queen is just very sad because she's lost her husband, and he's feeling his oats, and he likes the territory, so he marries her. How interesting. Well, Freud, in this story, he could identify with some parts of the story, and the parts of the story that he could identify with was feeling a great attraction to one's mother and a great hate to one's father. So that was sort of like where things were there. And Freud expanded on this, expanded on how these images appeared in one's dreams. And he had this book, Interpretation of Dreams. He had it, he had circulated it among thoughtful people, and he felt it was so important that he held off publishing it for 2 years until the year 1900 came. And he published it because he wanted that date on this, you know, his masterpiece. Freud, in Freud we have this sense of two things, of an incredibly thoughtful and deep person, but on the other hand, an incredibly blind person. Because right there in that same story was another kind of thing besides regicide and fornication with your mother, incest. And that was the original father and mother wanting to kill their child. Infanticide, we could say, is not something that he imagined, or imagined that he could have, or some way or the other his dreams didn't tell him. Because what is amazing when you read the life of Freud and all the people that he attracted from everywhere in Europe, that he was such a hard teacher that he, you follow me or you go. You follow me or you go. And so many people left. A few stayed, but nearly everybody went. And we can follow them throughout Europe, what they did, a former student of Freud. But Jung hung in for an incredibly long time with him, even though he would reflect, you're missing things. Because not only would Jung maybe be more comfortable with owning his own anger at other people, you know, the beginnings of infanticide or killing someone else, but he also said, there, if we saw that picture again, there's something beyond the here and now. And Freud, in spite of being in a culture, the Jewish culture, he wasn't a practitioner, but he was open to the Jewish culture. He was open to culture. Everywhere he went, he would get antique images, and his house was full of the imaginal, you could say. In his work, he was not. He was like a modern man who isn't interested in the beyond. But the first thing I want to assert that Jung did that I think brought him separate from Freud is that he believed being in dialogue with somebody who thinks differently than you is a good thing. Now, it's a good thing up to a point. One of the things you might not know is that Jung actually had a psychotic period that lasted many years. And it was as though the unconscious was saying to him, you have to follow your dream. Get out of this constant. So I bring this in also for us to realize with our battle with the unconscious or our battle with somebody who thinks differently than us, it's a high calling, and sometimes it's too much. You might have to take a holiday from it. Freud and Jung actually got back again in a strange place years later. Do any of you know about it? Yes. Believe it or not, Jung was better known in the United States than Freud was. So when Jung got invitations to come to the United States, he turned to his father and brought him in and was the one who introduced him. And that was after his breakdown and reconnection again, where his writings were really interesting. Just checking how much I've done here. Going back to the notion of Jung wrestling with Freud, I'd like to bring for us the image, or the archetype, we could say, of Jacob wrestling with the angel. I think it's a very powerful image. And for us, I have two relatives, one my sister, one my stepdaughter, who have a totally different view on the political situation. It's not easy. It's not easy to wrestle with that kind of angel. So when we say what would wrestling with the unconscious be, I think we might say that it's much more likely that we wrestle with figures that represent unconscious energies. So I'm going to just read a little until I get my throat. These things that come out of the unconscious that we have to recognize and decide, do we inculcate or do we relate to them? I think of them as coming as packages of energy. And so therefore we go through periods of time where we are really pretty serene. We're just like floating down the river and there's not. Thank God. Because when you've had a time of really wrestling with something, you can feel pretty wiped out, you know. Jung not only did not experience the unconscious as a place of despicables, I first of all wrote deplorables, but I thought maybe that wasn't, of despicable wishes and thoughts, but he thought of it all as potential aspirations of the future. And this whole part he called the personal unconscious. Now, why did he call it the personal unconscious? Because he recognized that this is something humans do as a people. we dream dreams and they coalesce. All of a sudden we find people with the same dream. Later on, he, you know, had other reasons, and some of the Jungians that I know are very sophisticated astrologists that see that the timing of some of these packets of energy that come visit us are loaded in one direction or the other. And so from time to time I'll go to my astrologist friends and say, how is it looking now? And they'll say, 6 more years of crap. You know? That's because, see, I don't know much about this, but it depends on where such planets as Saturn and Pluto, how they are in conjunction of each other, because they tend to be either things that slow you down or are dark. And they, when they get in conjunction, they have an influence. Let me just say this. I did have a very fine Richard Tarnas, devotee of astrology, and up to that time, I didn't give it another look. I don't think it suited to me because I can't remember anything, you know? So, I mean, at least I need something that I go back, I know what I've just read. But he said, it's not as though we think those planets affect things on the earth. But the planets are like clocks, timepiece. They mark when these influences are happening. And it's mysterious, but it is so beyond probability, the correlation. And to hear a person like this do it, I was in absolute in awe of it. So 6 years from now, let's rip out the tambourines. Now, in more recent years, Jung developed, much in debt to Freud, the notion of the personal unconscious. But he also posited the notion of a collective unconscious, in which the figures in it are the archetypes, which they consist, and this is an interesting and important point, according to the theory, a set of inherited expressions of ways of being in the world. So they are not considered like if a creator created and said, I'm going to give these to these people. This is something I bestow upon them. But if we instead maybe look back to billion years, then half a billion, now we're getting into the 100,000 years. We have humans in villages and they discover fire and all of that. The archetypes come out of that kind of accumulated experience. And imagine a neurologist could help us understand that when you discover fire, for instance, or you discover how to make fire, and it's not just the result of a storm, there's going to be a huge growth in the brain of the people because now they can control it and they can do some of the good things that fire does and avoid some of the bad things. And so we develop inherited ways of being, with dangerous things, for example. In the recent past, James Hillman has extended this notion of what we might call tending the soul of the world. In fact, Pacifica's motto is, I can't say it in Latin, I should, but for the sake of tending the soul of the world, it was a medieval idea that we do certain practices for the sake of tending the world. And what I want to say now is that I want to sort of like proclaim that as the goal of everything else I'm saying, that we would, so to speak, take a promise, or if renew our promise, that our life is for the sake of tending the soul of the world. The best things about being human on this side of that other picture. So, let's see. Somebody tell me what time it is.
5 more minutes.
I have 5 more minutes. Okay. The process that I have found most helpful in dealing with almost anything in my life, a gladness or something not so good, is the process of focusing by Jean Genlin. Could I have a show of hands of who are familiar with it? Okay. The process is called focusing. It's quite a misnomer, because in some way to do focusing, you have to do unfocusing and let focus emerge. Okay? So it's not... Focusing is, I don't think, the best word he could have used, but he got there first. I did a search this morning, or yesterday, for is there another psychological process similar to focusing? And my Google, that is usually incredibly responsive, went on for 5 minutes and came up with nothing. So I don't know what archives it was testing, but... What is this focusing that we're going to just sort of whiz through? Okay, focusing, Genlin is his name, G-E-N-D-L-I-N, and he goes by Jean, Eugene, Jean. And it has 3 parts to it that will be maybe all we'll look at right now. One is around anything in our lives, there is a bodily felt sense. So around being in this room, almost ready to go out and get some goodies and coffee, we have a bodily felt sense that we wouldn't have had maybe an hour ago. And that experience is bodily and it's felt. I've taught this on workshops where we've, you know, been in a ratio of 1 to 5, and I know how hard it is to get it. So sometimes it can help if we sort of shock ourselves. Suppose you opened your bill from the bank and you see you're overdrawn. Can you let yourself feel that? Where'd you feel it? Here? I felt it here. Up here? Here? You know? But you could feel it. That is that's pure gold, to be able to feel it. For anything. Even a feather touching your nose. Okay? Then, Jean says that if... suppose it's not a good feeling. If attended to in the right way, it will shift and you will have an expression of it. And the expression could be an image, it could be a word, it could be a phrase, it could be a gesture. That's an expression. Unsafe is an expression. It would be, it could be, and this can happen like this, it could be a memory of you as a child being in danger. But we have to cultivate this. Now, if we take the bodily felt feeling and we take the expression and you resonate them together, that requires a certain degree of focus, but it's not focusing yet. But that's sort of where the word came in. You let yourself say, is this a match? It would be like if you're trying to pick out a tune on the piano. And if you're not a pianist, you most likely don't get the first note right until you try another one. Ah, you do that intuitively in loads of places. If we're cooking, you know, we have a felt experience on the tongue. We resonate that with my idea of a good chili. It's missing. It's missing something. And then we put that in, and the resonate will be, ah, I'm right on. Oh, shucks, I put too much. So these three parts, experience, expression, and resonating, right? Can I go a little over? I hear the... Go on. The... What Jenlin says is that the resonating of these two yields a better place if what we're focusing on is distressful. It always moves in that direction, though it might go down further. We might not really have gotten the worst of it. But the other part is that we can focus on good things too. And it actually is sometimes helpful to start to do this process by saying, gosh, I love my mother, don't I? And, you know, it might be lukewarm. And if you stay with that, with a sense of openness, that back to one we talked about, that is, without judging, because judgment is nearly always demeaning. It's mean-spirited. So if we can stay with that, we can get, we might come to, oh, what I need to do is forgive her. Oh my God. And you feel bigger. You feel like you have air to breathe. So you could focus on something that is just terrible, and the worst thing that can happen is that you'll go a little terribler before you start to come to aha moment. I remember the longest focusing I did was when I went back several times to Chicago to study with G.G. and then his cohorts. And I was with this woman, and I came up with a common feeling I had of shame. And she was so wonderful because she kept sitting with me over this shame, just shame. And I mean, it was there. And you know what came out finally? I was 3 years old, and I had pooped in the background. And I had a nanny at that time, and we were from the West Indies. And she found me. Miss Dawn, you do not do things like that. I felt utterly shamed by her. And, you know, like she promised she wouldn't tell anybody. I was 3, maybe 4. And I had carried that. That had in some way colored my... I'm not, like, shame-free. We never should be shame-free. But it doesn't do good for us to be shameful. You know, there's a place in between. A place when something is proportional. Not dealing us a death knell. And I've never gone back to that place. And I am grateful for it, I find myself, because I think it's good to go back to those shifts you've had and be grateful for them. Full of gratefulness, full of gratitude. And then the other side would be times in which you have had this and you have you're doing something you really do love, and you can just stay with it and allow yourself no boundaries in the felt sense, and then see if there's an expression. Is there oh my God, I cannot believe my guardian angels or somebody have moved so much stuff from in front of me, because I haven't had the challenges I see. Being a therapist, I see people who have had a pretty hard time, you know, and for some reason I didn't, whatever. If I had to watch my time better, we would have had an exercise here. But, yeah, or other things. Thank you. Thank you.
Enjoy your break. Please visit the tables for books and for important things to do. Thank you.